CKUT is going online for our 2020 annual general meeting. Join us on Monday, November 23rd at 6 p.m. to hear how your favorite community radio station has been adapting to the current pandemic by broadcasting remotely. To find out how you can get involved in one of our various committees, to propose a motion, or find out more information about joining our Board of Governors, email culture at ckut.ca. That's culture at ckut.ca. Monday, November 23rd at 6 p.m. online, CKUT's annual general meeting. To RSVP for the event, email agm at ckut.ca. That's agm at ckut.ca. Hope to see you there.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razozan. This week, we bring you the second part of the interview with Professor Stefan Asturian of UC Berkeley about the military conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, as well as the latest ceasefire agreement between the two countries over the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh in the South Caucasus. Later in the program, Khalil Bindeep speaks with Professor Ali Ahmida of the University of New England about the UN-sponsored ceasefire that was concluded by warring parties in Libya's civil war. Do stay with us. On November 10th, Russia brokered an agreement between Armenia and Azerbaijan, two former Soviet Union republics in the Caucasus. The deal brought an end to a new round of fighting that had erupted on the 27th of December between the two countries. At the heart of the decades-old conflict is Nagorno-Karabakh, a mountainous region of just 150,000 people. In 1991, when official dissolution of the Soviet Union began, the mostly Armenian inhabitants of Nagorno-Karabakh declared independence from Azerbaijan following a referendum that was boycotted by the region's Azeri population. The declaration sparked a war that led to the loss of 30,000 lives, the displacement of more than 1 million people, and reports of massacres committed by both sides. Most of those displaced in the war were Azerbaijanis. By 1994, when an internationally brokered ceasefire was declared, ethnic Armenians controlled almost all of Nagorno-Karabakh, plus seven surrounding Azeri districts that gave them a buffer zone and a corridor connecting the region to the Republic of Armenia. Since then, Nagorno-Karabakh, also known as Mountainous Karabakh, has been run as an independent entity with Armenian support but no international recognition. This week, we bring you the second part of the interview with Professor Asturian about the role of external powers in the conflict. But first, he starts by telling Shahram Aghamir about the terms of the peace agreement between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Stefan Asturian is the director of the Armenian Studies Program at UC Berkeley and professor of the politics and history of the Caucasus and Armenia.
What happened is that the Azerbaijani army advanced and conquered Shushi, which is a historic city overlooking the capital of Nagorno-Karabakh, Stepanakert. And the Armenian chief of staff, the president of Nagorno-Karabakh, the chief of the army of Nagorno-Karabakh, and the Armenian prime minister, after consultations, reached the conclusion that this was it, and they had to agree to a Russo-Turkish plan that had been in the making for several days. What is the content of the plan? Well, it's very simple. Basically, the conflict is frozen where the positions were during the day when they agreed to this plan. The Azerbaijanis are going, obviously, to keep all the territories where they had advanced, Fizuli, Cebrail, Zangilan, to the south. They have taken Shushi and they are going to keep it. And then Armenians have agreed to basically withdraw from other territories that they had been controlling around Mountainous Karabakh proper since 1994. So they will have to evacuate the region, the rayon, as it is called, of Kelbajar by November the 15th, 2020. They will have to evacuate the Agdam region to the east by November the 20th, and they will have to evacuate the Lachin rayon or region by December 1st. So what you will have left is an area, Mountainous Karabakh proper, the self-proclaimed independent republic, shrunken down in relation to what it was even in late Soviet times. So you have a mini Nagorno-Karabakh that will be left with, again, Stepanakert, but Shushi in the hands of the Azerbaijanis. 1,960 peacekeepers, Russians, will be positioned all over the place, including at the border of Armenia, but in Nagorno-Karabakh and the surrounding territories. The Russians are going to control the corridor of Lachin, shrunken down again to about 5 kilometers wide, linking Armenia with Nagorno-Karabakh. So there will be a corridor, and something totally new, there will be a corridor between the Azerbaijani exclave of Nakhichevan and Azerbaijan to the south near the Iranian border. This last point is quite unexpected, but is the first step of Turkey's overall goal, that is direct linkage with mainland Azerbaijan and not merely the exclave of Nakhichevan. And now Turkey is going to have that linkage via a new road to be built, linking Nakhichevan with the southernmost part of Azerbaijan, those territories that are now under Azerbaijani control again. Both corridors will be apparently controlled by the Russian peacekeepers. In addition, there will be a monitoring center located in Azerbaijan itself, that is outside what is left of Nagorno-Karabakh and the territories that have now been taken over by the Azerbaijanis. So it will be in Azerbaijan proper. And it would seem that that monitoring center, it was agreed upon, will also have Turkish presence. So it will be apparently a Russo-Turkish monitoring center. What is interesting in this agreement is the following. There is no mention at all of Turkey, even though this agreement was reached after Russo-Turkish negotiations. It's as if it's only Russia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. That's the first point. There is no mention of Turkish peacekeepers anywhere, but now President Erdogan is talking about Turkish peacekeepers. And the Russians are saying, no, there aren't any, and that was not agreed upon. Third point, the status of what is left of Nagorno-Karabakh is not discussed at all in this agreement, whether it will be some form of minimal autonomy, more extended autonomy, whatever it might be, independence, which is extremely unlikely now. That is not dealt with. And President Ilham Aliyev, during a TV speech, poked fun at the Armenian prime minister, saying approximately, Nigol, what about the status now? There is no status. So I would be a bit surprised if some kind of status is defined about what is left for Nagorno-Karabakh, even though the Russians are assuring that the status of what is left will be discussed next. Final point that is totally unclear, the road going from Nakhichevan to Azerbaijan, linking the exclave with the mainland, is that road considered to be Armenian territory, crossing the region of Zangezur, quite close to Iran, as I said, monitored by Russian peacekeepers? Is that road internationalized? Is that road considered to be Azerbaijani? All that is unclear. Finally, this arrangement about 5 years, the peacekeepers, it's a 5-year arrangement, and the agreement stipulates that 6 months prior to the end of this agreement, the two parties involved, that is Armenia and Azerbaijan, if one of them rejects the renewal of this agreement, then theoretically the peacekeepers have to go back home. Now, there is a problem with that. I don't think I will be turning it into a new Nostradamus if I predict that Azerbaijan has no interest in renewing the presence of Russian peacekeepers. I am not a gambler, but I would bet that in 4.5 years or 4 years and 3 months and so on, Azerbaijan is likely to say, okay, we are done with the peacekeepers now, everything is fine, and go home. Azerbaijan is unlikely to want to renew for 5 years the presence of peacekeepers in that area. The second problem is that usually when you get Russian peacekeepers, they tend to be sticky. That is, I don't know if they will go home. I also have doubts about that. And since I said finally, I will say finally, the type of troops that Russians are bringing into that region as peacekeepers, these are not average soldiers that are going to do peacekeeping. These are elite troops from Ulyanovsk. I have read that some of the best paratrooper troops that Russia has, including military intelligence, GRU, Petsnaz, special forces, and so on. So these are not people who are going to sit down and just watch if something happens. They are really elite troops that also can fight until some reinforcement arrives. So this is the overall configuration of the agreement. And in Armenia now, there is major uproar and unrest about this agreement and accusations against the prime minister and the president of Karabakh of being traitors.
Earlier in our conversation, we did discuss the role played by Turkey in this conflict. Let's go back and talk more about what Turkey's end game is. Turkish-Azerbaijani relations have been described by the officials of the two countries as quote-unquote one nation with two states. They refer to historical, cultural ties, so forth and so on. Nearly half of Turkey's natural gas supply is imported from Azerbaijan. Also, there are more than 800 companies in Turkey operating with the Azerbaijani capital. And vice versa, there are Turkish has some investment in Azerbaijan too. These Azerbaijani companies have invested billions of dollars in energy, construction, tourism, and real estate sectors. Yes. There are more than 1 million Azeris, and the figures are not clear. We don't know exactly how many. The estimate is anywhere between 800,000 to 1 million living in Turkey, and we know that 300,000 of them are Turkish citizens.
The economic dimension that you have mentioned is absolutely valid and crucial. Today, Turkey wouldn't be the hub for energy in the Middle East, for gas, oil, transportation, without Azerbaijan. So that is absolutely certain. That is, the causes for Turkish policy are not just purely ideological. Neo-Ottomanism, the so-called Sultan Erdogan wants to reconstitute the Ottoman territories. And no, it's much more complex. Okay. The man is absolutely pragmatic. He appears to be enraged and so on, megalomaniacal in his expressions, but he is extremely calculating. And the Turkish state, it is a very deep state. It's one of the two states in the Middle East that has centuries and centuries of real existence. The other one is the Iranian state. The other states are mostly post-colonial constructs. Of course, there are nuances. You know, Egypt has existed for millennia with a brilliant past. But what I am saying is that the two states, leaving aside Israel, you know, that was created in the 20th century, people who reduce Erdogan to this or that, they don't know Turkish, they don't know enough Turkish history, and they underestimate the depth of the Turkish state apparatus. So the decisions for Erdogan are multi-layered. He has huge interests, as Turkey is the hub of energy transportation in the Middle East, is trying to get more of that in the Eastern Mediterranean, as you know, and even Western Mediterranean, up to Libya, is trying to carve, supposedly, a zone of economic influence via proxy. It has geopolitical interest. It has its eyes set on the South Caucasus and linkage later on with the rest of the Turkish world. This is what's also going on through this conflict. And let me tell you that this conflict will not end with Karabakh. The Karabakh conflict is only one stage. What Turkey wants, and as a result Azerbaijan wants, is direct territorial linkage between Turkey and mainland Azerbaijan. Not just with Nakhichevan, the Azerbaijani exclave to the south. So they need to cut the region of Zangezur so that Turkey can go from Turkey to Nakhichevan and from Nakhichevan straight to mainland Azerbaijan. To me, that is the ultimate goal. So I am extremely pessimistic. If I hear somebody telling me, okay, if we settle this issue, it will be finished, I don't buy it. There is the pan-Turkish dimension in the long term, army of Turan, you know, building the army of Turan and so on. So and there is the internal political dimension. Ultranationalism sits well with Turkish public opinion. So he's pursuing many, many goals, and one cannot reduce or underestimate his skills in foreign affairs.
Let's talk about another actor in the region. Its borders are far from Azerbaijan or Armenia, and that's Israel. Israel is Azerbaijan's second largest supplier of military equipment, following Russia, and Turkey comes third. In 2016, Azeri president announced that Azerbaijan had purchased $5 billion of weapons from Israel. Since then, the volume has increased and is estimated now to be at $7 billion. Mm-hmm. Israeli military and security firms benefit from selling to Azerbaijan a range of weapons that include artillery, ballistic missiles, naval vessels, intelligence equipment, and drones, including attack or self-destructing kamikaze or suicide ones. Azerbaijan is also the largest exporter of oil to Israel, providing it with about 40% of its annual consumption through a pipeline that goes through Georgia to Ceyhan, a port on the Mediterranean coast of Turkey. Israel's heavy reliance on Azerbaijan's oil may change now that it has restored diplomatic relations with UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan. Well, not quite with Sudan yet, I suppose. How would you characterize the Israeli-Azerbaijani relations? Is it simply transactional?
You know that Israel, despite the rhetoric under President Erdogan, has had very deep ties with Turkey for decades in all fields. It doesn't matter that some Turks might pay lip service to the Palestinian cause and this and that. This is all for internal consumption. The reality was that the military establishment, the intelligence services, the states have been fully collaborating for a very long time. Israel today might well be even the number one country selling armaments to Azerbaijan. I believe they have easily exceeded the more than $6 billion, you know, easily. And they are sending more and more armaments in the course of the current war. I follow some very specialized sites about flights and so on over Georgia. And there are many, many flights going to Azerbaijan from the area of Israel. And I suspect these are not tourists. Why? Well, I think there are several causes, and there is a cause that I would like to emphasize. In addition to the oil, gas, and so on, is that I believe both Turkey and Israel and some of the Western countries. You know that Iran has been built up, the image of Iran as the ultimate enemy, a breeding ground of international terrorism and so on. All that is part of the rhetoric. The hope in the medium to long term is to create massive unrest in Iran on the part of the Iranian Azeri population. Historically, Azerbaijan referred to the northwest of Iran, Tabriz and so on. It has never referred to the area where you have the post-Soviet Azerbaijani Republic. That had another name historically until, for pan-Turkish reasons, they adopted the name Azerbaijan in early 1980. And the direction of the conflict, I found it very interesting. The fact that they organized the attack along the Arax River, just on the other side is the Iranian area, Iranian Azerbaijan. Over the past few days, Iran has accumulated troops, elite brigades, assault brigades. I saw on Twitter specialized feeds of Twitter, you know, anti-aerial equipment and so on. The Iranian regime is very well aware of what those goals are. He's not happy at all about this war. And I believe the main reason why Israel is so enthusiastic in its support for Azerbaijan is that it has listening stations there, it has intelligence agents, apparently it has been the base for operations within Iran. It is said, but I cannot check it, of course, I don't work in those organizations, that the nuclear documents that were spirited out of Iran, you know, went through Azerbaijan and so on. So it seems to me that that is number one cause. I may be wrong. Then there is the economic dimension for the time being, gas, oil and so on. And I view that. And then I believe there is, among some Israelis, a particular dislike at the idea that Armenians also underwent genocide. I am not saying all Israelis, all Jews, that's not at all my point. Personally, some of the people who have been the friendliest, the most helpful in academia have been Jews. So I don't want what I am saying to be distorted by some people. But there is a segment that feels that the Holocaust should be the only mass extermination, genocide in history. There are many reasons. There are also, apparently, I notice a lot of Jews from the former Soviet Union, including Azerbaijan, who are now in Israel. I believe Avigdor Lieberman is from there also. Some of those people have come with particular agendas. So far as I know, not many of them are on the liberal wing of the Israeli political spectrum. I am not a specialist of Israel, but I see a lot of extreme right-wingers coming from that area.
Speaking of Israel's former foreign minister, Lieberman, he said, and I quote, "Azerbaijan is more important for Israel than France." That's what he said in 2012. In March, Azerbaijan's finance minister gave a speech at the annual AIPAC policy conference in Washington, D.C. The Israeli lobby in general has been helping the Azerbaijani regime get access to Congress and the U.S. administration. What can you tell us about that?
Just lately, actually, over the past 6 or 7 days, I came across two documented studies. One of them is on how Azerbaijan is trying to influence the U.S., dealing with the U.S. public opinion, political parties, the Democratic Party, Donald Trump. You even see the name of Podesta, you know, and so on appearing. It's fantastic. Regarding the Israeli lobby itself, AIPAC, unfortunately, I don't have much information about this specific topic, that is AIPAC and Azerbaijan. But over the past week, I could read some short studies, extremely documented, showing how Azerbaijan has been working over the past years to spread its influence, including, by the way, in the media. And over the past few weeks, because of this war, I can tell you that a few of those lobbying firms that had been generously paid by Azerbaijan, probably because of the war and because of the Armenian diaspora here. I don't know why. They have put an end to their contracts with Azerbaijan.
Let's talk about Russia. During the war of 1990s, when Azerbaijan was trying to escape Russian influence, Russia quietly but effectively supplied Armenia and the Karabakh fighters with enough hardware to give them the military edge. Presently, Russia has good relations with both Armenia and Azerbaijan. Russia is the largest supplier of arms to both countries, even though Russia and Armenia are members of the Collective Security Treaty Organization military alliance. And there is a Russian military base in Armenia. What are the Russian interests in the region? Does it have, and does Russia have the credibility to be an honest broker in the conflict and the ensuing agreement, particularly when it appears that Russian peacekeeping forces will be stationed in the disputed region indefinitely, possibly, as a guarantor of stability?
There are various discussions, both in Russia and, you know, international observers, high-level press like the Financial Times, who won. So one argument is that Russia lost here, that Turkey is the big winner. Turkey has asserted its influence now in the South Caucasus. Russia's power is waning, is slowly disappearing, and so on. That's one interpretation. The second one is that it's 50-50 with, of course, 50-50 means that Turkey got quite a good arrangement here. And there is a third interpretation. It seems to be in the minority that actually Russia did great. Let me start with that interpretation because it is quite interesting. Russia has been wanting to bring its peacekeepers in that area at least for the past decade, at least. That was its main goal. And as I said, usually Russian peacekeepers, I use the expression, they are a little bit sticky once they are somewhere, you know, they don't disappear very promptly afterwards. So they are there now. Russia, under Foreign Minister Lavrov, had encouraged Armenia to give back territories. That was the so-called Lavrov plan, and bring in Russian peacekeepers. That was essentially the Lavrov plan. A variation, again, of the Madrid discussions of the OSCE Minsk group with the addendum of Russian peacekeepers. Now, Russia has essentially realized that the regions, not five, all of them are going back. Nagorno-Karabakh itself is truncated, diminished in size, and the Russian peacekeepers are there. It is also asserted that maybe the Turks have had a say in Azerbaijan and so on. They are going to be part of the conflict monitoring center. But you notice their name doesn't even appear in this agreement. It's Russia, Armenia, Azerbaijan. They consider that as a major victory for Russia. Finally, the argument goes, this whole war behind it, there was NATO and Israel indirectly behind Turkey, the goal being to bring the South Caucasus under Western influence. They have already Georgia, you know, or substantial influence there, quite a bit in Azerbaijan. And of course, there was the agenda of surrounding also Iran, maybe providing bases for Israel to possibly attack Iran. You know, there is talk about that in Azerbaijan itself. And the Russians are claiming this. They say, have you noticed? There isn't even a mention of the Minsk group, the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Insofar as the Karabakh problem is concerned, there is a subgroup of the OSCE called the Minsk Group. And that Minsk Group created a smaller group of co-chairs, US, France, and Russia, dealing with the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. And those who believe that this arrangement is outstanding, actually, for Russia, say, look, the names of the US and France don't even appear. They have been totally left aside. Russia has asserted its total primacy in the area and prevented further NATO and so on, the spread of their influence in the South Caucasus.
Changing the geopolitics of the South Caucasus and essentially by shifting the balance of power.
Yeah, and what has Russia lost in this story? They say not much. In addition, it has destabilized Mr. Pashinyan and his pro-Western inclinations, shown to Armenians that outside Russia they have nobody. They shouldn't rely on the empty words of the Europeans, on the nice comments by Americans. When push comes to shove, the only people that have agreed to send peacekeepers to Nagorno-Karabakh, they say, that's us, Russians. If not, they say, the rest of Nagorno-Karabakh would have also disappeared, probably in the course of the next 2 weeks. I don't believe this interpretation is to a great extent invalid. I think it is overall right. The only thing it tends to reduce is the influence of Turkey. Turkey now is going to have bases in Azerbaijan itself, very clearly a military presence. Suddenly, even though that's not mentioned in the agreement, it claims that it will have peacekeepers, which the Russians have rejected over the past day and a half very clearly. They have said all that we agreed upon is a monitoring center in Azerbaijan itself, but no peacekeepers at all.
Yeah, we are getting two different narratives from the two sides.
We are getting two different narratives, whether it's for plausible deniability by the Russians, that look, we didn't want that. Erdogan, you know how he is, suddenly he has reneged on the agreement, and what can we do now? Or whether they didn't agree at all, the Russians, to that, I don't know, I cannot check that. But basically, it would be foolish to underestimate the Turkish success in this matter. And Turkey being a member of NATO, and NATO having stayed totally silent almost, with the exception of a few empty sentences, there needs to be peace and this and that. I mean, you know, the totally vacuous diplomatic language. My interpretation is that actually NATO was not backing militarily the Turkish adventure, but supporting it indirectly. NATO has, access to satellites and so on for geolocation, on the basis of which you can use drones and rockets and so on with utmost precisions. And Turkey has access to that. I have read it has used AWACS airplanes just across the border from Armenia to guide drones and so on. So I view NATO as being indirectly, very indirectly, of course, supportive of Turkey and far from condemning it for a single-handed adventure in an area that usually is under Russian influence. And Turkey has received that corridor from Nakhichevan to mainland Azerbaijan. I mentioned that in the long term or medium run, the goal is direct linkage, full linkage, and this is indeed the first step and a very significant step, even though we don't know exactly what the status of that road will be, as I mentioned also again a little bit earlier. Will it be considered Armenian territory, internationalized territory, Azerbaijani territory? That remains unclear at this point. Finally, the main loser is very clearly Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians and Armenia itself. And that leaves Iran, basically.
When the fighting broke out on September 27, the government of Iran stated that it was a neutral mediator in this round of fighting. This position was consistent with Iran's official policy since the 1990s. The Iranian regime called for the implementation of the UN resolutions and denied Azerbaijani accusations that the country was facilitating arms transfers from Russia to Armenia, while Azerbaijani officials repeatedly denied allegations from Iran, Russia, and international media reporting on the use of Syrian mercenary fighters in the conflict. Additionally, Iran has a large Azeri community, and there were protests in Tabriz in support of the quote-unquote territorial integrity of the Republic of Azerbaijan. In Tehran, the regime's primary concern has generally been the formation of an economically powerful and democratic republic in Azerbaijan. Of course, what you have there now is far from that. A republic which can potentially stir up Azeri nationalist sentiments in Iran. How do you think the Iranian regime views this agreement, this truce brokered by the Russians?
Shahram, the plan that Iran presented, you summed up the main points. But its main idea was the format. The format was that Iran, Russia, Turkey, the important regional players, are going to solve this problem. Again, the goal was to leave out of any kind of arrangement Americans, Europeans, NATO, this and that. So the line adopted by Iran was quite similar in its format, at least, to the approach adopted by Russia. Don't allow, essentially, the U.S. or its proxies, Europeans, to have a say here in our region. Iran had also drawn a very clear red line that it will not tolerate and accept any change to the borders. And indeed, there hasn't been a change to the borders, to the Zangezur border with Iran, for example, to Mehri passage towards Iran. The road that is going to be built is further inland from Nakhichevan to the, must be the Zangelan district, I believe, the southernmost district, but well above Mehri, away from the international border between Armenia and Iran, and Nakhichevan and Iran is further inland. So my guess, because knowing what's going on is, of course, very difficult. At the same time, it must be stated that some of those countries might have divergent positions internally. There is a state position, but there might be different opinions within the country. That has become very clear in the case of Russia, in the reactions that can be observed there to this arrangement. So in Iran, you might have also two groups of people with different attitudes, one more very clearly sympathetic to Azerbaijan, others having a much more negative view on that and being much, much more cautious about Israeli presence there, NATO presence there, and so on. So it's hard to tell. But basically, I believe this arrangement is not good for Iran, but is tolerable for Iran. It amassed more than 140,000 troops on the borders. That is no joke, 140,000. It was a very clear signal. So I believe this is not ideal for Iran, but acceptable. And I am sure Iran has also observed the type of warfare that has been going on. This has been a very innovative case. So far as I know, it's the first case where hundreds of drones have been used. Sometimes hundreds of mini drones, you know, kamikaze drones and so on, many, many larger drones. This is a new type of warfare. And I am sure Russia has also learned quite a bit from this type of warfare. And I have heard it is trying to develop much more efficient weapons against these drones. So it has also been this war a kind of mini laboratory for a lot of people to predict the next type of similar war.
Stefan Asturian is director of the Armenian Studies Program at the University of California, Berkeley, and professor of the politics and history of the Caucasus and Armenia. He spoke with Shahram Aghamir. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. We'll be right back. On October 23rd, a long-awaited UN-sponsored ceasefire was concluded by the warring parties in Libya's civil war, followed by negotiations in Tunis, bringing hope for a possible solution to chaos and civil war in Libya. Khalil Bendib spoke with Professor Ali Ahmida of the University of New England in Maine about the chances of this historic agreement to survive the bitter internal dissensions and foreign meddling that have plagued the beleaguered North African country.
Libya has been split since 2014 between different factions, one based in Tripoli in the capital in the west, and one other major one in the city of Benghazi in the east. The Government of National Accord, GNA, which is recognized by the United Nations, and the National Liberation Army, General Haftar, in the east. On October 23, less than a month ago, the two sides agreed to a UN-sponsored ceasefire. Tell us what the status of this ceasefire is.
Well, the background to this ceasefire is the failed assault on Tripoli. General Haftar, who established law and order in the east and in the south after that, prepared himself to what he claimed to be liberating Tripoli from the militias. That war started much earlier in April 2019, and it didn't go well as he anticipated, like his war in the east and in the south, because there were groups that opposed to him, and also the entry of Turkey with its drones, with its Syrian mercenaries and technological drones and so, tilted the weight of the war toward the Government of National Accord and the armed groups that are supporting it. So that assault failed and forced General Haftar and his troops to withdraw to the region, central region of Jufra and Sirte. That action, you know, led to an unanticipated result, almost of a balance of power or balance of terror. And the UN mission and the key powers called for a conference in Berlin that included many, many of the major actors in Libya and also the UN, the National Security Council members. And they agreed on halting foreign intervention and calling for a ceasefire and a plan to negotiate for a peaceful transition and also an election after that. That agreement, which was a turning point to a degree, built on the balance of power after the attack in Tripoli, as I said, and gave an opportunity for negotiations. People are skeptical, but I would have to say it's really an interesting truce.
So there are talks scheduled to begin in Tunis in early November. What is the status there?
Well, the Berlin Conference, you know, stipulated three committees, military, economic, and also political dialogues and negotiations between the East and the West. And the military negotiations really went well, I think, due to the fact that many of the officers belong to the traditional Libyan National Army that has 60 or 70 years old. And they actually surprised everybody for agreeing to disarm the militias, unify the institutions and the army and so. And their meetings in Morocco, in Cairo, in Geneva, all asserted the 5-5 negotiations that led to some really pressing agreement and compromises between the two sides. The political one is a little bit tricky, and all the attempts before did not really lead to dismantling the main causes of the conflict, the security and also the foreign intervention and compromise between the two factions. So this meeting in Tunis is really pivotal in many ways. The UN representative, Stephanie Williams, called 75 delegates from various factions and various groups, independent Muslim Brothers from the parliament, from the Sarraj government in the West, even members of the Gaddafi regime before 2011. And they have been meeting for the last 4 days in Tunis, in the neighborhood of Gamart, a suburb of Tunis. And they have been negotiating an agenda to resolve the conflict and call for three issues that are crucial. The first one is to call for an election reduce the presidential council to a new president and two deputies. Also called for specific plan to call for an election and the mechanism for that. And also the issue of the constitution, what to do with the constitution. This has been, been negotiated for the last 3-4 days. Ms. Williams had a press conference yesterday, very optimistic, and claimed to have a breakthrough in the negotiations. So the there has been negotiations. And Khalil, I think here we have two ways to think about all of these developments. The military committee has done surprisingly well, as I said. The committee, the political gathering in Tunis, I think many people are skeptical about it because there are objections to who should be invited to this meeting. And as you know, Khalil, in the Euro program, over the years, we have talked about this. There are so many meetings, so many conferences on the Libyan conflict and the Libyan civil war. And I think they became just, they didn't lead to much progress. And to the conclusion that we are not talking about resolving the civil war, resolving the crisis, but managing the crisis, because nobody could tackle the compromise because of the Libyan leaders, and combined with the factor that the armed groups that are opposed to rebuilding of the national army and police and the proxy war and the foreign intervention in the Libyan civil war all blocked any real compromise or any real coexistence and resolving the armed conflict. So what has happened is conferences after conference, declaration after declarations, but the causes and the factors behind the conflict have not been shaken yet. And now there is an opportunity. I'm a little bit not completely pessimistic, not completely optimistic. I'm up to a pessimist, if you like. I think there is a chance, but that has to be guaranteed by compromises by the Libyan delegates there. And quite honestly, the outside forces have also to be part of this compromise. The Libyan conflict, like the other civil wars in the region, are not just a domestic conflict. They are also regional and international conflict as well.
So two questions. First, you said there were three avenues. There was the military, there was the political. What was the third one?
There is the economic and also the public national institutions. For example, there is a conflict over the central bank and the national Libyan oil company. As you know, most of them are located in the Tripoli, in the western part of the country. And Libya gets most of its national revenues from oil and gas as a rentier country and rentier economy. So the who control that are the national institution of the central bank and the oil national company. And there was tremendous corruption and lack of ability to audit and observe where the money goes on. And some observers, including the UN, they stated time and again that the widespread corruption in Libya is really unbelievable. It's almost kind of pillaging the national budget. So there was a call to audit the national the central bank and also make sure that the national oil company is also audited and observed. So the corruption and the informal dealing and wheeling and the pressure by armed groups and by other allies in the region and smuggling and really in getting deals has to be stopped. And there was a call for some sort of auditing and control of this corruption. And also, there is also another proposal to see if, beside auditing these institutions, is to maybe distribute the location of these institutions, not just in Tripoli, but in other places in the country, in the east and also in the south.
So you mentioned, when it comes to the political round, that the deeper causes, according to you, are not being addressed. What are some of the deeper causes that should be on the table and they're not being addressed?
I'll start with a factor that the Libyan elite, unfortunately, had, or the Libyan uprising had original sin, and I would describe it that way. Reliance on the outside forces. Since 2011, in the fight against the Gaddafi's regime, the intervention of the NATO Air Force was disastrous in a way, because it really ushered in the beginning of a heavy intervention and role of outside forces, Europeans, regional forces, Turkey, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and of course, the United States to a point in toppling the regime. But the elite itself, I think, committed a horrible mistake where they were naive and opportunistic in asking for outside forces to defeat their rivals. And that really internationalized the Libyan civil war. And Libyans began to really ally with various patrons and forces. And I don't think that has stopped today. For example, Khalil, you look at the Libyan Islamist, Muslim Brothers, the Libyan Fighting Group, and the other groups who came from Afghanistan and Iraq and other places. They are a minority. They are armed and disciplined. And also they relied on support from outside, and they feel like this is their chance to really have control. There are also other exiled Libyans who came from, like the case of the Iraqi opposition. They really wanted to collaborate whatever government they have in the United States government, France, Germany, UK, Italy, Turkey, Qatar, Egypt, and other patrons. That really hardened the positions and did not really encourage them to reach a compromise and have the decision in their own hands. I'm afraid, Khalil, that this really failed leadership has abrogated its decision. And now the mover and shakers are outside forces. Now, it's never too late to reconsider this and see where they have to compromise and give up their hard positions to reach a compromise and where everybody will be accounted. That hasn't been taken before. And the Skhirat agreement in Morocco 2015 really did not resolve the conflict. It created a new position for some forces inside the conflict, but did not resolve the militia, the armed groups, the foreign intervention, and therefore it became really a formal recognition of the status quo without resolving it. So what happened on the ground, the powerful groups, they are really in charge, but the Sarraj government did not really have much power and relies on international recognition as a weapon to silence any opposition or any criticism of its position. In the East, General Haftar is problematic because he's another strong military man who is calling for the unity of the country. But at the same time, it's not clear whether he want to respect difference, whether he respect diversity, whether he would respect opposition inside the country. It's not clear whether he was really will appoint his sons or not. There are a lot of ambiguous issues with General Haftar, despite the fact people in the East and in the South and even some in the West at the beginning thought he might be, you know, a lesser evil or at least would bring stability and law and order. That seems to be really now is really in doubt. But we cannot deny the fact that the East and the South had more security than before he rose to power and became a major actor in the conflict. He's old and ill. We don't know what might happen to him in the coming years. But now there is a small chance that, you know, the Libyan faction and Libyan delegates in Tunis might really exercise some self-criticism and look at the commonalities and the future of the country that accommodate all of them. Whether that happen or not, I am not really sure. But there is a small chance, Khalil.
To finish, I would like to ask you a little bit of detail on what positive steps or what agreements the military side seem to come to. So we'll end on something positive.
We need something positive, aren't we? Even in America, we need something positive in this very trying time.
Yes, exactly.
We can't lose hope. The first to start with, Khalil. We have to be realistic and not gullible or dreamy, but hope is important to all of us as human beings. In the Libyan conflict, I'm optimistic about in the long term because of two factors. First, I think the military professional officers, so that they don't belong to this faction or another, they're still loyal to something called Libyan national interests. and to the institution of the Libyan army that was founded long, long time ago, 1949. And I think in that sense, it's not surprising that agreed to disarm the militias, to call for foreign mercenaries to leave the country, to reunify the army. And they stated that in their agreement, and they were aboard on these issues. This is really a huge factor behind the Libyan conflict. So I give them a lot of credit. I give them a lot of high points in that. I am optimistic also because recently Libyan youth marched and protested in the streets of Sabha, of Tripoli and Benghazi, protesting against corruption, calling for all Libyan national transition. And that maybe was late, but I was delighted to hear that because I always believed in the fact that the silent majority, the Libyan public opinion, have been intimidated but not really dead. The third important positive step, I always thought that the Libyan people, despite the war and 20 million pieces of arms around the country and foreign intervention and everything, the country is still functioning and staying alive. And the municipalities is a good example to look at, a good hope, because they have been managing their countries and their neighborhood and their towns, and they have been going through election after election. And that shows me that the Libyan people are resilient, despite the fact they went through a horrible, horrible counter-revolution and civil war and foreign intervention and a failed leadership.
Ali Ahmida is a professor and founding chair of the Department of Political Science, College of Art Sciences at the University of New England. He's the author of the new book, Genocide in Libya, Shar, A Hidden Colonial History. He spoke with Khalil Bendik.
That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
Our media partner is the Status Hour podcast and Jadalia Ezin. You can find us on Twitter at @Vomina_radio or listen to our past shows on iTunes or SoundCloud at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can also reach us by email at vominaradio@gmail.com. Please join us next week for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, and thank you for listening.
In the fight against COVID-19, we must all continue to respect public health guidelines and follow self-isolation instructions. Self-isolate if you have symptoms. Self-isolate after testing. Self-isolate if the test is positive. Self-isolate when you return from a trip. And self-isolate when you've been in contact with someone who's tested positive. Self-isolation is important. Please, take it seriously. Learn more at quebec.ca/self-isolating. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Tandis que nous poursuivons la lutte contre la propagation de la COVID-19, de nouveaux programmes de soutien sont en place pour les personnes qui en ont besoin, notamment un régime d'assurance-emploi plus fort et plus accessible, ainsi que 3 nouvelles prestations de relance économique. Continuer à soutenir les Canadiens maintenant nous aidera à assurer notre sécurité et à rendre le Canada plus résilient. Consultez canada.ca/le-coronavirus pour en savoir plus sur les nouveaux programmes de soutien aux revenus. Un message du gouvernement du Canada.
CKUT on the air, live, CKUT. CKUT,
CKUT. Hey, this is Clem from White Cowbell, Oklahoma. And baby, don't you touch the dial because you got it locked on 90.3 FM. CKUT. Ta-da-da.
amici, giovani sposi, si amavano di tutto cuore, aspettavano il frutto d'amore e felice vivevano così. Dopo 11 mesi precise, ecco nata una bella bambina, ma per sua sventura e rovina, orfanella nel mondo restò. Che Nicola ha finito il lavoro, come al solito a casa tornava, una sera Luisa incontrava e di lui se ne ricordò. E fermandolo sul marciapiedi, come mai gli disse a Nicola, la promessa è la tua parola e non sei venuto perché. Senti cara, non posso venire, come sai c'ho già la mia sposa, è una figlia la piccola Rosa, che mi è nata un mese fa. Lei guardando a Nicola gli dice, non ci credo a questa ragione, ma se perdi questa occasione, non m'avrà.